Grief comes in many forms. First and most personal, there is the grief that comes in the loss of someone we cherish. When such a shattering death comes, the heart will never be unbroken. Another kind of grief is where what we've lost isn't a person, but part of ourselves. The loss of our health, the loss of some of our potential, or our friendships, or our sense of belonging, or of our faith. And then there's the grief that pertains to larger events and realities around us. We grieve the war in Ukraine, grieve the devastations of COVID, grieve the evils of racism, grieve the abandonment of the poor, grieve the attack on transgender people in Texas, grieve the wounded earth. But there is another kind of grief. This one pertaining not to someone or something that once was and is lost, nor grief because of catastrophe in the present, but grief for what might have been but never came to be. Something longed for. Maybe worked for, strived for, waited for, anticipated joys that never came, opportunities that never opened, dreams that didn't make. That kind of grief has attended the pandemic. Over the past 2 years, so much of what might have been was not. We think of teenagers and children and all they might have learned and the finding of new friends there or the deepening of old friendships, all kinds of experiences and celebrations that ought to be part of growing up, never happening for them. The same is true of the church. We thrived during the shutdown, ministry still happened, and new ministry happened, and some new possibilities and successes emerged. But nearly 2 years of not being here together, think of what might have been that is lost to us. The growing relationships, face-to-face connection and care, new people, shared inspiration, shared vision, new memories never formed together. We are left with an unspoken grief, not even able to name how much has been lost. It had to be lost. Given what is required of us by kindness and love. But this too is grief in need of healing. Grieving what might have been can be part of anybody's life. There's something we've hoped for, dreamed of, counted on. A certain kind of life, a certain kind of relationship, a kind of future we envisioned but were denied. Something got in the way and said no to your hope. And you're left with a kind of forward-leaning ache, reaching forward toward what once you thought was there, but isn't there at all anymore. And the dream dissolves. You may know these lines from the musical Les Miserables. I dreamed a dream in time gone by, when hope was high and life worth living. I dreamed that love would never die. I dreamed that God would be forgiving. But the tigers come at night with their voices soft as thunder, and they tear your hope apart, and they turn your dream to shame. Maybe you've known such grief. Maybe you care very much for other people who know that kind of grief all too well. Jesus did. Jesus had a dream that didn't make. Something he longed for, prayed for, worked for, wept for, didn't happen. The saving of a city, the holy city, the Temple Mount they envisioned was where the world lifted up and God leaned down and earth and heaven met. The Holy of Holies was there, and great music and prayers were raised there, and here was the consecration of children and the teaching of God's ways. This city and its goodness were to be a light for all the world. But politicians were there, pardon me. The judicial system was there, and the center of the economic system was there, and a cabal of clergymen, pardon yourself, making deals with the powerful. So, mixed in with all the genuine piety and goodness of many of the people in that holy city had come a spirit of meanness, arrogance, the misuse of power, and the poison of it flowed outward, and the damage it had done spread through the land, and total destruction was on its way. Jesus saw it coming. And so there came a day when he stood on the Mount of Olives, looking out on that city, and he broke down and cried. He wept for them, and wept, I think, also for himself, that he couldn't save it. Wept as well for the many brave and honest people who had lost their lives there trying to speak the truth. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killer of the prophets, how often I have longed to gather your children like a hen gathers her brood under her wings, but you would not. His heart is breaking for a future that will not be. His longing has been met with such resistance that this door has closed to him. There were systems he couldn't change, people he couldn't win over, miracles he couldn't work. He knows the terrible helplessness of love. And the tears on his face are the tears of God. For the world. And we can take our place with him there. To the weeping Christ, we can bring our own heartbroken disappointments. And with him, we can lament the truth of what we have not been able to achieve. Lamenting also what has resisted us. The people and the systems and the events and the incapacities of our own, maybe something even in ourselves. With Christ, we offer all heartbroken disappointment and regret and tears into the great and boundless love and purpose of God. not the traditional site of where this happened, the site of where Jesus stood on the Mount of Olives, looked out over Jerusalem and lamented. In that place, there is a small chapel now, which has the name Dominus Flevit, which is Latin for the Lord wept. The building is shaped like a tear. And on each of the four exterior corners are figures representing tear vials, an ancient sort of small bottle for preserving tears and sanctifying them. Behind the altar inside that church is a large plate glass window so that all who enter can see the panorama of the city that Jesus looked upon and wept. He grieved, but then he entered. And within those walls he worshiped, and touched people with wholeness, and taught, and threw down the furniture at that temple, and confronted the powers that be. And of course, their resistance grew deadly. And so they took him outside that city and put him to death. He knew it would happen, and he gave himself to it. But we must never forget that along the way, he confronted these people in power. His power to confront was a wonderful thing to behold. Did you notice, I'll bet you did, that in today's text, his lament over Jerusalem follows instantly after he sends blistering words to a corrupt king. Some people had come to Jesus saying, "Get out of here. Herod's trying to kill you." This was Herod Antipas, ruler of Galilee and subservient to Rome, but still a king and vicious. This is the man who had arrested John the Baptist and beheaded him. Now he wants to kill you. Go away. But Jesus says to them, "No. You go away. You go and tell that fox to listen. That I'll keep right on doing what I came to do, making people whole, not fearing your threats, you old fox." Why call him that? I really like foxes. Why call an evil king a fox? I think it's because foxes are crafty and stealthy and efficient killers. Though in fact, not so powerful. Just as Herod compared to Rome was nothing. With a similar fierceness, Jesus calls out the corruption of the clergy. And then to the governor who represents the emperor of the empire, Jesus says, "You have no power." All these men in high positions, their efforts to protect their own power, feeding off others, opposing the plain command of God for justice and mercy, Jesus calls them out. "Go tell that fox." And we can follow him there as well. Where the powerful oppose God's longing for the world, we see them for what they are. And we call them out. We raise our voice to speak the truth and show the truth and live the truth. As Jesus did. Most of all, we give ourselves to His desire. How often have I desired to gather you as a hen gathers her brood beneath her wings? The man who's castigated a king and now has tears in his eyes is longing to be like a hen who in time of danger stretches out her wings so her chicks can run to take shelter there, protected from storm and from predators such as a fox. The hen putting her body between danger and her vulnerable young. But the holy city wouldn't let him do it. And the foxes took charge. And Jesus did stretch out his wings. And the cross they nailed him to faced him toward the city that he could not help. And when he cried, my God, why have you forsaken me? It meant in part, surely, why does the city, your city, refuse? But now, in the great darkness of God's mystery, unknown to them, their very refusal and hate of him, which is to say the very failure of his longing, became precisely the way that God changed the world through him. He would rise to life outside the wall and would appear to some within it and make them free, and the world would change. All of it, I think, speaks to the dreams that have died or are on the verge of dying in us. Our grief for what might have been, our experience of the terrible helplessness of love. The heartbreak of Jesus speaks to our own heartbroken disappointments and shows a way forward. For having grieved his losses, didn't he go on and didn't he shine? Didn't he love well and live his purpose and keep faith and keep courage and with all his passion pour out himself? Then new life surged in him, and the world changed. We have been speaking this Lent of giving up our illusions about perfect life, perfect self, perfect world. The Spirit here is inviting more trust that what we are given by God's grace is good enough, more than good enough for living, loving, serving, belonging, keeping faith, being joyous, and going on to grow and to grow. Let us then have courage to live with some disappointed dreams, and with the willing acceptance of our limits, giving to God all the rest. And listen, new doors will open to resilience, to joy, to growth, and the fulfilling of our purpose after all. That, friends, that will be far beyond good enough.